Teach Me to Code, Episode 50. Hey, everybody, and welcome back to another Teach Me to Code podcast. This is your host, Charles Maxwood, and this week we're going to be talking to Chad Fowler. Now, Chad is one of the organizers of a lot of the Ruby conferences out there, but he also wrote a book called The Passionate Programmer, and he talks about building an excellent or remarkable career. And you know, he really had some great career advice. So I'm going to go ahead and turn that interview on in a minute. But before I get started, what I want to do is I want to introduce our sponsor. We're sponsored by NewRelic.com. And New Relic, they're just an excellent tool, a great way to monitor your web application. They monitor Ruby, Java, PHP. I think they're working on or have .NET. So if you have a web application that you need to keep tabs on, keep track of, that's an excellent way to make sure that it's performing the way that you want it to and figure out where your problems lie. So go check them out at www.newrelic.com. Or if you go through the website and click on the link there, then we actually get a little bit of a commission there. So if you're going to check them out, then that's a good way to support the podcast. Also, I wanted to let you folks know that I'm going to be teaching a Rails course. That course, if you want to learn Ruby on Rails, will start the end of March. It's an online course. You go to codelesson.com, just click on the link for Ruby on Rails. And if you sign up there, then it's either starting Monday the 28th or April the whatever the Monday after is. I think it's the 4th. So, you know, you can go over there and you can sign up for the Rails course, or you can go to teachmetocode.com/Rails course, and it'll take you directly to the page where you can sign up. Finally, if you need help with your Ruby or Rails application or just want to leave feedback for the show, you can do that by calling me at 801-367-6164, or you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/cmaxw. You can also email me, chuck@teachmetocode.com, and I appreciate all of that feedback. You can also go to the website and click on Request a Topic and tell us what you'd like to hear about, both on the podcast and on the screencasts. And finally, I just want to thank our sponsor again and thank Chad for coming on the show. And I'll go ahead and turn on the interview and I'll catch you on the other end. Thank you. Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the Teach Me to Code podcast. This week, I'm here with Chad Fowler. Now, if you remember, Chad was on the podcast last year. I think it was almost a year. And anyway, are you still the CTO of InfoEther? And
I am still the CTO of InfoEther. That is correct. Right.
And he's written the book, The Passionate Programmer, which I read in November, and that's why he's on the show. But he also is one of the driving forces behind the International Ruby Conference and Rails Conference that I think this year it's going to be in Baltimore again.
Yeah, that's right. So I'm also, I must mention, the author of Rails Recipes, and I wouldn't normally bring that up because it's kind of old, but I've been slaving over Rails 3 Recipes, which I hope will be in beta in February sometime.
Oh, nice. And is that going to be released through the Pragmatic Programmers?
Yep, that's right. It's basically the second edition, but it's a fairly major rewrite because I wrote Rails Recipes before Rails 1.1 came out. So I was referencing, like, in the future in Rails 1.1 or in Edge Rails, you can do such and such. It's really interesting to read back through those old recipes and see how things have or haven't changed.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, because I was talking to Michael Hartle, and he was talking about the Rails tutorial, and he had originally written Rails Space back when we were using, like, 1.1 or 1.2. And they added all the rest stuff after that, among other things. And so, yeah, he was saying that when he wrote the Rails tutorial, he couldn't just update what he had because it didn't work the same way.
Yeah, exactly. It's not a matter of porting existing recipes. Some of them don't even make sense in my case. You know, it's like, oh, you wouldn't actually do that in the modern Rails world. So it's an interesting kind of forced exploration of the history and evolution of Rails, though. I'm enjoying it from that perspective.
Yeah, that's really, really interesting. And I would be interested in, you know, knowing some of the problems that you ran into in updating the book. But anyway, we're here to talk a little bit more about, you know, creating a remarkable career. That's the tagline on your book, creating a remarkable career in software development. I have to say that this is a book that a friend of mine, Michael Moore, who organizes the Mountain West Ruby Conference, said that every developer should read. And so I picked it up. And after reading it, I have to agree. So just to start out, I'm a little curious. There were a lot of points made in this book. What do you think is the most important thing that people can do to kind of make their career a remarkable career?
Well, I probably said something like this just by chance on the last interview we did, now that I think of it. So I'm going to say kind of the same thing again, but I'll change it a little bit. The most important thing is actually developing and then expressing to yourself the intent of having a remarkable career. But I should actually back up from that. So that's probably what I said last time, and I still believe it's true. Most people are just kind of walking through their careers like lemmings, you know, just going with the flow wherever their employers take them, whatnot. But as I wrote the book, I had an idea of what remarkable meant to me in terms of a career. Mm-hmm. And I've come to realize that it's very important to explicitly evaluate for yourself what having a remarkable career means. So, I mean, you don't even have to use the word remarkable. So, for example, I have met people who they want a steady job where they can go home at night and hang out with their kids and their families and, you know, have a great time being productive during the day, be very important and essential, but not have to be even a team leader. You know, just be someone who cranks out good work, feels good about it, and then goes home and rests. Uh-huh. And I think, you know, as I was writing the book, I wasn't really thinking about that person. Because I've always been the sort of person that is just driving to, you know, get ahead in some way, and whatever my definition of ahead means. But usually that's like, you know, when I was in the corporate world, I had my sights set on being a corporate CIO, you know, some sort of CTO, mm-hmm. a big company, you know, big team making important decisions that you see, you know. And then I changed directions, which I describe in the book. I decided, you know, I don't want to be a high-level manager like that as much. I want to be deeply involved in technology. But so remarkable career to me then kind of got redefined to be being peers with the people whose work had inspired me and, you know, made me more creative and made me feel more intelligent, basically being in that kind of an environment as often as possible. So therefore, for me, remarkable career has translated into writing books and speaking and organizing at conferences, you know, doing training, collaborating with big names in software development. But I realize now that it can be kind of a downer for somebody who maybe is going with the flow and really just wants to get their career on track. Like, you know, they don't want to be a famous programmer or developing Rails, you know, creating the new thing, the next big thing. They just want to be successful. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I even have to redefine for myself and recalibrate what success means in my career.
That makes sense. That makes a lot of sense. And, you know, I can kind of see the same track, probably not as long as your your career, because I've been in development for 4 years now. But, you know, it's the same kind of thing where it was, oh, well, I just want to learn how to do this. And then it went from there to, oh, I really want to be, you know, excellent at this. And yeah, now I'm getting to the point where I'm thinking, you know, I want to associate with the developers of a certain caliber and, you know, yeah, be considered their peer and that kind of thing. I'm a little curious too, how do you manage all of the things that you're doing? I mean, cause you're organizing conferences, you're doing the training, you find time to write, code, you have a full-time job, you have a family. I mean, how do you manage all of that?
I don't know. So, you know, a lot of people would have a good idea or good answer to that question. Like I use GTD or I use the Pomodoro technique or whatever. The funny thing is I consider myself to be completely unorganized and one of the world's worst procrastinators. But throughout my career, especially as I started like mentoring software developers, I always get asked this question. And I remember when Facebook came out, it's kind of a funny thing. You know, those stupid things where you take surveys about all of your friends on Facebook and then it pops up like this person is the smartest or this person is the most energetic or whatever. I remember it popped up on my friend feed once that my friends had voted and I was least likely of all their friends to be voted the smartest, which was just awesome. And I was most likely to be voted most organized. And I thought, this is ridiculous because I am so absolutely unorganized. So I don't know. I think what I do is I obsessively focus on stuff for short periods of time. I remember having a conversation with a friend back when I worked at a big company where I was talking about I felt like it was like a short attention span issue where I'm basically just doing lots of things all the time. And I realized that it's sort of a strength that I'm unorganized in this way. So it's kind of like the shotgun technique. You know, you just shoot toward a kind of general area and some things will hit and some mm-hmm. things won't, and kind of scatters. But the things that stick are good. So probably if I was forced to answer the question, which I guess I'm not really, but let's say I was, probably the secret is that I just do so many things. You only know about the ones that were successful. You don't know about all the little projects that I start all the time that I don't do anything with.
Okay, I'll buy that. Now I have the book in front of me and there are a few things that really stuck out to me that I wanted to talk about. One of them was, and I think it's the first chapter actually, it might tie into the first part of the second chapter, part one, part two. Anyway, you talked about kind of, you want to be on the bleeding edge or you want to be on kind of the trailing edge. Right. And you talked about how that kind of, restricts the market with which you're competing. And it allows you to be kind of a specialist that people need. And I thought that was really interesting. I was wondering what experience you have with that and what made you kind of come up with something like that.
Yeah, well, really it's all supply and demand. So, you know, there's nothing too remarkable in it, except I'd say that most people understand the idea of being on the leading or bleeding edge, being a differentiator in a good way. Right. Mm-hmm. Most people are like, you know, especially software developers, they want to chase the new exciting thing. And they understand that if you position yourself right, like I did luckily with Ruby as an example, you know, I got into Ruby when nobody else was taking it seriously in the US or very few people were. And I just stuck with it, even though there was no sign that it would take off. And mm-hmm. It was really not that I made some like intelligent business choice. I was just having fun. But then all of a sudden Rails came out and I had been around and done stuff like contributed to Ruby gems and all that stuff. So that's kind of the classic be out on the leading edge so that if something hits, you've already got a name, you've already got experience. The thing that most people don't consider, and I guess it's just human nature, but they don't consider the fact that technologies die. Oftentimes, they die as their experts retire or start to retire. So the pool of people who know a technology kind of naturally gets smaller because of attrition in that way. Mm-hmm. It also naturally gets smaller because everyone's moving on to the next technology. So, you know, maybe it's RPG or even COBOL. Mm-hmm. I can't remember the statistic I found on COBOL, but the number of lines of COBOL still running in production today, it's amazing. And I don't know about you, but I don't ever just run into a COBOL programmer in the wild anymore, you know? So who maintains these systems? Who keeps them alive? And the reason that I learned this is because I've had a few experiences, especially in big corporate America, where I have seen aging technologists retire or, you know, quit or whatever a job and then come back as a high-priced consultant because they're literally like the only person or one of two people that know how to deal with a system.
Right.
You know, one case was where we had a mainframe with its own custom TCP/IP stack because it didn't actually, the operating system didn't have a custom or a TCP/IP stack, and its own custom RDBMS.
Oh, wow.
And the guy who did all that was ready to retire, but basically retired, hired young people and trained them and started an ops team that came back as a contractor for the company. And, you know, he was absolutely critical. If he was gone, we were screwed. So he could kind of name the price. Huh. So we didn't have a choice.
That's amazing. And I don't know. Do you think there are technologies now that are going to be that way in a few years?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, there are certainly technologies that are already there. Like, to say COBOL is dead would be ridiculous.
Right.
But it's certainly dying. And the analogy I use, by the way, in the book is technology hospice. Like, you're taking care of technologies as they're dying, helping them die gracefully, helping them transition. Mm-hmm. I would say, you know, stuff like even Java on old frameworks, mm-hmm. Or even stuff like, you know, VB6 and before. Sure, you can just you can rewrite in .NET or whatever, but there are some huge systems that have to stay in production, you know, can't be immediately rewritten because people don't even know the business rules. So if you're someone who's like really deep in VB6, you could probably, if you had the right personality, make a killing as a consultant supporting VB6 applications that have to stay in production, even as, you know, Microsoft stops supporting it. And, you know, how do you get it to actually continue to run on an updated version of Windows and that sort of stuff?
Right. Yeah. I think it's interesting though that. I don't know. You think of these systems, you know, even the older versions of Java are fairly, you know, I guess people consider them fairly recent. And so, you know, yeah, you wouldn't think of them as technologies that are dying out, but you do have a point there. I want to change gears a little bit. There was another thing that really struck me, and that was in chapter 10, Love It or Leave It. You were talking about how, you know, people, I guess, haven't just they know what they want to do, but they haven't quite found the right place for themselves. You know, the kind of finding a job that you love. What recommendations do you have for people to identify, you know, that job that they're gonna love?
Well, I recently, not too recently. You know how that is when you get older. It's not very recently at all. But I posted this thing on my web blog because I realized that the way that I did that was I asked myself the question, what would I rather be doing? Mm-hmm. So ask yourself, you know, in the middle of a busy work day, what would you rather be doing right now? In a way, I got into the computer industry because of asking this question, because I was playing music, you know, like at a bar at night, and I realized I'd rather be at home continuing to learn programming, which I was doing as a hobby. And of course, my music friends thought, what a waste of time. I also was wasting time. I was playing a lot of Doom and stuff. But I realized that I would rather be learning programming than standing in a bar playing Mustang Sally or Hold On, I'm Coming Again. Mm-hmm. But since then, I've done that on a few occasions, and it has really helped. So it's just, you know, if there's something that you can answer that question with, then go do that. Gary Vaynerchuk actually at a talk, I don't remember where it was, but he was talking about finding your passion. And he basically said, just find the thing that you're thinking about all the time that you're really into and try to make that be your job. And his analogy or his example was, you know, if you're way into Smurfs, then do something having to do with the Smurfs, you know, try and start a business around that. Mm-hmm. I know that from experience that most corporate developers are typically standing around every day, like at the water cooler or in someone else's cubicle, and there's some period of the day devoted to complaining about corporate politics and who has what job and whatnot and where they want to get. So most people know, at least implicitly, what they'd rather be doing. And I think that's at least the good first step. You know, sometimes it may be like, I'd rather be watching NFL right now, and you know, you can't directly translate that necessarily into a career as a programmer. but there are different ways to deal with that. So it may be like, okay, I want to work for a company that has a site that's related to sports, for example. That might be a goal. Mm-hmm. Or it could just be, I want to work at home. So I can be sitting around watching TV while I'm working. So how do I do that? You know, so I have more freedom. But that question, I think, leads in the right direction.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's interesting. I think, you know, it's for me, I've never really been in a position where it was, you know, because if it was something I would rather be doing, I'm usually already doing it. I mean,
right.
Whether on my time or, you know, whatever. It gives you kind of that direction, that idea of, okay, well, you know, maybe this is the next big thing, that I need to be into, you know. And, for example, one thing that I'm really interested in is, I have all kinds of Apple products laying around, and I keep thinking, well, gee, it would be really fun to, you know, build something that runs on my iPod or on my iPad.
Right.
And so, you know, that's something that I've been wanting to learn. And so, you know, I guess at that point, then, you know, you come to that next level where, you know, your next section is about investing in your product and you know, becoming better. And so how do you actually go from, okay, I know what I want to do, or I know what niche I want to be in, you know, or where I know where I want to be at. How do I get there? You know, and you talk about some things like learn to fish or find a mentor, you know, but how do you actually do that? How do you find a mentor? Or how do you learn to do what you want to do?
Yeah, well, you know, so when you say investing in your product, the whole idea behind the book is that I have broken up the phases, although they're not serial phases, but the phases of career development in the same way that you might break up the phases of running a business. So the product in this context is you as the product that you're out there selling.
Right.
So, you know, going from deciding you want to do something to actually being able to do it, really, it's this investment step that gets you there. Just like I have all these ideas for like startups. I don't know how many ideas. Like, you know, most people like us are constantly thinking, oh, there should be a business that does this. I could do that. All I have to do is build a product. And then what I don't do is actually build the product. I just think, well, that would have been cool.
I have that problem.
Yeah, I think we all do. So it's that investment that gets you from I want to do it to I'm doing it. And you said something when we were talking about what you'd be rather doing or what you'd rather be doing. You said you're usually already doing the thing you'd rather be doing either during the day or on your own time at night. I would say that if you're having to do a lot of the things you'd rather be doing on your own time at night, there's still an opportunity there, right? What you want to do is take that stuff that you're excited and passionate about and replace what you have to do every day with that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So in order to do that, there are a bunch of different ways. So, you know, I mentioned like finding a mentor and whatnot. Let's just say, as an example, it is a technology thing. You know, I would rather be doing Clojure programming, but I'm stuck doing Rails at work, as an example.
Mm-hmm.
So the first step actually is to do what you said, to start doing Clojure programming on your own, right? You come up with a project. Dave Thomas talked about this in his RubyConf keynote this year. He said, you know, he and Andy have always talked about learning a new language every year, but he says this year, don't just learn a new language, you know, don't just learn the syntax or the paradigm, actually develop a sizable application. And I can't remember the number, but he actually gave like at least this many lines of code and put it in production. So that's an awesome thing to do, especially when you have, you know, Rackspace Cloud and EC2 and all these things available to you. You could do an application that does something really small in the language of your choice, in the technology of your choice. Maybe it's not a language. Maybe it's like, you know, NoSQL databases or Hadoop or whatever.
Uh-huh.
Do a real application that's small, put it into production, and then maintain it and have it out there, you know, actually doing its work. now you have real experience, not just I goofed around with this at night, but I own the site blahblahblah.com and it analyzes Twitter for people talking about pizza that they ordered and decides whether or not, you know, the pizza is good. Something stupid like that.
Uh-huh.
You can put in production and then cite as you start talking to people about jobs that you have real experience with it. And the truth is you actually will have real experience. You know, you may goof around with Clojure or Erlang or something on your computer, but until you actually deploy it and then have it go down and you don't know why it's dead and have to debug it, you know, for your site to go up so you're not embarrassed anymore, you don't really have experience with it.
Right.
So I'd say that's the thing. If you follow the lean startup world at all, they have this concept of minimum viable product.
Uh-huh.
Pick some app that maybe is not going to change the world or ever even make you money, but pick an app idea, distill it to the minimum viable product, and then develop and deploy that in the technology of your choice.
Huh. Okay. I can really get behind that, you know. And I mean, whether I'm getting a little echo coming back.
Oh, I wonder why I have headphones on.
Oh, okay. Anyway, so yeah. Well. Anyway, so that's distracting. Sorry.
Do you want to disconnect?
And let's do that.
All right, you call me this time.
Okay.
All right. Is there echo?
Nope. All right.
Good.
So, yeah. So I really like that idea. I mean, I brought up iPhone development, and that's a pretty obvious, you know, avenue.
Right. Yeah. Do you want to do a game, or do you want to do like a data web service kind of thing?
Right.
What's your idea there? I'm actually asking you now.
Well, I have several. You know, I have one idea where, let me think. Basically, you put together like, it's kind of like flashcards, except, you know, instead of just, you know, you tapping it and having it turn over, or give you the answer, or whatever. I would like some kind of auditory, you know, answer. To be used for learning a language or teaching your kids to read or things like that. I think that would be really something interesting. So when you say, give me the answer, it actually says it. Another idea I've had is I'm not keen on any of the Pomodoro technique timers that are available for the iPhone or the iPad. I don't think they the iPhone's kind of hard because they expect you to like type stuff in on it, and that's just, I think it's ridiculous on a screen that small.
Yeah.
But the other thing is they don't really give you any feedback as far as, you know, how well you did or anything like that. Like, they'll track your Pomodoros, but that's about it. And some of them don't pause well, and some of them don't do some other things well. And so I would like to see something that works a little bit better and that integrates with my task manager. So, you know, with Pivotal Tracker or Basecamp or whatever I'm using.
Right. Yeah, so the interesting thing about both of those ideas is you could make a like robust, sellable application,
mm-hmm.
or you could say like there's probably one thing that you'd like to use the flashcard app for initially, mm-hmm. for yourself.
Right.
It could be a generic flashcard app, but at first you could just make it actually have like hard-coded data and audio.
Right.
And it's an app for, you know, helping your kid learn to read, and that's all it does.
Yep.
You know, or it's an app for learning verbs in Spanish, and that's all it does.
Mm-hmm.
So you could do something really simple there. And of course, the Pomodoro thing, you have very specific ideas about what makes it different from the ones you don't like. Maybe you don't yet integrate with Pivotal Tracker or Basecamp, and when you do, you pick one, you know.
Right.
But you do as little as possible. It's funny, the timer thing, the first app that I did on iOS for the same reason of, you know, I want to have developed an app on iOS was a Tabata timer, which is basically like the exercise equivalent of Pomodoro. You do really short, intense, high-intensity interval exercising for just a few minutes, actually. But I wanted a nice thing to do that with, and I wanted to be able to do it on my iPhone, so that's what I built.
Yeah, makes sense. Did you actually put it on the iTunes store, or did you just use it yourself?
I just used it myself.
Okay.
Yeah, I think, you know, if you really want to get serious, you definitely want to go to the App Store, especially since when it comes to the Apple App Store, that's the worst thing about doing Apple development anyway. It's that, then it's Objective-C, then it's the rest of the normal stuff you have to learn.
I've heard that, the submitting to the Apple App Store is the worst, but I haven't done it yet, so we'll see. One other thing that I wanted to go into, and this was something that I really liked, was the story about the mind reader guy. I'm trying to remember.
Oh, yeah. His name was Rao, actually.
Uh-huh.
So, basically, this is a story about execution and being someone who is seen as a doer, you know? Mm-hmm. There was one guy that I worked with, and I still kind of think of him as legendary. I think probably all of us who did, who worked with him thought the same way. But I would have conversations with him, and it was when I was leading a team, and he was working on various aspects of the technology that was driving an IT infrastructure, basically. We had our own framework in Java. It was pre-Struts, and he had done a lot of the work on it, most of the work, actually. So we would have these conversations where we would be brainstorming ideas while waiting for the coffee pot to, you know, finish.
Uh-huh.
And many times I would say, you know, it would be really cool if we could make a change to the framework and do this and that. And it's like my thought process was just kind of congealing around this new way of using the framework. And many times he would respond and say, oh yeah, I did that last week or earlier this week. I just committed the code.
Uh-huh.
And it was bizarre. We all kind of got the sense from him that he could read our minds and that he was always one step ahead of us on what we were going to want him to do. So his productivity, it would take him negative time to do things, basically, because he would do many things before we ever asked for them. And the way that he did that was, I believe, you know, I haven't really interviewed him to ask him about this, and I haven't talked to him in several years, but I believe he just really understood our motivations. You know, like he understood what the challenges were for me as the leader of the team. He saw the pressures that I felt for the team, and he put himself in my position very well mentally to think, what would make this easier? What is he probably already thinking?
Mm-hmm.
So he was very well aligned with the needs of the team and the needs of the business. So whenever he had free time and he wanted to experiment with something or clean something up, he wouldn't do the thing that's been bugging him. He'd do the thing that he thought had been bugging me as essentially his customer.
Right.
And so from that perspective, you know, you don't have to be a genius like him to get some benefit from this idea. If you put yourself as closely as you can into the perspective of the person you're working for or your customer or whoever it happens to be in your organization, you can at least be pushing things in the right direction. You know, you don't want to do too much, especially when you're spending someone else's money for your time. You don't want to go off and develop whole new app features without asking.
Right.
But if you're always trying to align what you're doing with what you believe their exact needs are, you can kind of get this effect of seeming to be even more productive than you are.
Yeah, I just thought that was amazing. You know, the whole thing, you know, where, yeah, I mean, you basically pointed out that he, you know, he was listening to what was going on and then, yeah, paying attention to what your needs were. And I, you know, it really just struck me. I mean, you know, the value of a person to an organization is as much what they're capable of as what they do. And in this case, he increased his value, not necessarily by being any more technically savvy, but by paying attention.
Right. Yeah. And I would actually say that you have understated what you just said. You said it's just as much what you're capable of as what you do. I think it's all what you do, actually.
Uh-huh.
And this is something I really had to teach myself as a manager, especially. Like, I've hired people that I know are geniuses, that are smarter than I am and, you know, more capable than I am. But if they don't do anything, they're worthless.
Right.
So it's frequent that I have seen the motivated, organized execution machine of a person who maybe isn't the smartest or most technically savvy totally outperform the brilliant artist of a programmer.
Right.
And, you know, it, when I say it's what you do that counts, I mean that 100%, but I also include into it's what you do stuff like, you know, doing is talking to other team members and teaching them. It's not necessarily mm-hmm. just creating code. But if you're capable of something and you don't do it, you're wasting everyone's time and money and you're underselling yourself.
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, I've been on, I've been a team lead. I've been, you know, I've been in on a lot of the management meetings and stuff. And yeah, I mean, ultimately, yeah, if somebody's not executing and you know that they can, it's almost, well, it's really frustrating. And it's almost, you know, to the point of, okay, well, why do we have this guy here? Because we brought him on to do this and he's not.
Yeah, if you're looking to lay someone off as a manager and you're given two people who are executing at roughly the same level, it might seem like the obvious choice is to pick the one that's not as smart. But the thing is, the people who have to make up for their limitations develop systems for making up for those limitations. Mm-hmm. People who are underperforming, there's, you know, based on what their capabilities are, there's usually not an easy way to make that switch.
Right.
Because they're already making a choice, basically, to underperform. Whereas the person who, you know, isn't naturally talented has not made that choice to underperform. They might be really giving it everything they have. So which one do you want to reward? The one that is slacking or the one that is, you know, busting their butts to perform? The other thing that I have learned that is totally relevant to this, I read this book by Haruki Murakami called What I Talk About When I Talk About Running, which expressed a sentiment that I've now seen echoed actually in fitness books. Haruki Murakami is just a novelist, but he says that he is naturally the kind of person that gets fat if he doesn't exercise or he doesn't eat right. Uh-huh. And his wife is naturally skinny. So they can do the same amount of exercise and eat the same bad food. He will get fat. She'll stay skinny. And it used to make him really jealous. Uh-huh. But then he realized that he's lucky to get fat. And I get fat too. So in a way, I'm lucky too. Because when I get fat, it's my body's way of telling me, you're unhealthy. If you keep doing this, you're going to die. You're going to get sick.
Right.
Right? You know, you're not supposed to be big. Skinny people, though, if they don't exercise, you might not see it, but they have visceral fat, you know, uh-huh. which means like fat around their organs. They can get just as sick and die of something that you would expect would only fat people would die from. Uh-huh. But it's the same exact like physical situation. Now, to bring this back to on topic, the difference between people like Haruki Murakami that get fat and his wife is that if you're not naturally able to stay thin and you want to be thin, then you develop a system for yourself to do that.
Right.
And that's what I've had to do. You know, I'm naturally a fat person. At least if I behave like a typical American, I'm naturally a fat person. So I have to develop a system that involves eating right and exercising in a rigid, systematic way. And I've done that. And I'm not in the best shape, but I'm certainly in better shape than I ever have been. And I'm probably healthier than a lot of skinny people as a result, even mm-hmm. though I'm, you know, not yet a skinny person. So the same thing is true in the workplace. If you come into a job and you have someone that's just brilliant and never has a problem, they don't develop a system that results in consistent results. Mm-hmm. You know, they have bursts of brilliance, bursts of insight, and then sometimes they kind of flounder. Whereas someone who is not naturally gifted has to develop a system and will therefore usually deliver more consistent results once they get up to a certain level.
Right. That makes a lot of sense. And, you know, it's interesting because I think we all do it. You know, I think we all form these systems, you know, to compensate for the areas that we don't excel in. And, you know, it's something that you do see between programmers, you know, the guys that just kind of get it and breeze through it, and the guys that, you know, have to work for it.
Right.
Now, have you noticed, you gave a fitness analogy. Have you noticed that there's a difference between, like, fitness of developers and their skill level, or, you know, anything like that?
Do you mean, like, a connection between fitness and skill level?
I guess that's more what I'm looking at, yeah.
No. No, I mean, there are probably things that I could guess about that, but I won't.
Okay. Now, another question I have, and I guess as a CTO, you could be considered, quote, a suit.
yeah, although I never wear any suits, but sure.
Well, it's interesting because when I was working for Mosey, which is just it's a backup company out here, the technical folks, and it was a term that I had never heard before, called the business folks and especially the management folks a suit. And you know, it was somewhere between a derogatory term and just you know, just something we called them. And you know, it was interesting, but at the same time, you know, the suits are people that we have to deal with on a regular basis, and in a lot of cases they're people that can really make a difference both in our careers and just in our ability to perform. So you have a whole section on dealing with suits. What recommendations do you have for developers who are have to deal with management on a regular basis?
Well, the first thing I would say is, and probably the most important, is that the idea of calling them suits and thinking of them as different is a slippery slope. It can lead to problems. Most developers, I don't know if this will continue to be the case as technology progresses, but most developers think of themselves as being part of an elite group of, you know, hacker geeks that understand computers. The whole idea is it permeates popular culture. You know, stupid TV shows always have the nerdy kind of jerk of a person that, you know, doesn't have to be nice to people because they're so brilliant and they can look up stuff on the computer while the FBI team is out in the field. Mm-hmm. So we have this idea that we are somehow better than the less computer literate business users or, you know, stakeholders in the projects that we're developing, as if they can't understand a very simple language that we understand. So step number one in learning to work with people like that, which is basically everybody except for programmers, if you think about it, is to understand that while they may not understand our terminology, you know, if you blah, blah, blah about design patterns, it's going to sound like total gibberish to them. You probably don't understand what they do either.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what it is about computer people, you know, like programmers, think that they can do everybody's job better than they can. You know, everyone's an armchair politician. Everyone's also an armchair manager, an armchair CEO, whatever.
Right.
Try being in that position and you will be humbled very quickly. So, you know, I guess respecting that there are different disciplines is the most important thing you can do. Then I would say that once you've at least, you know, internalized that, rather than go out and try and teach everybody about what you do, take a less selfish approach. And, you know, let's say you're in a backup company, right? Mm-hmm. Which you were. The suits might be salespeople. They might be managers. They might be CEO, chief operating officer, whatever. Try learning what they do. So, you know, typically you'll be working on one piece of a system if you're in a big organization. So you might be like focused on the sales system. So meet with some salespeople and learn as a human, you know, when they go to work every day, what are they trying to do? What makes life easy? What makes life hard? Learn their terminology. Or maybe it's, you know, operations. Learn how to read like the balance sheet of your company and see if that's something that's okay for you to do. Understand what your company's operating expenses are and what the challenges are of the people who are trying to manage all that. Most developers don't know that stuff. And so from that perspective, they're really like a bunch of business illiterate zombies floating around speaking a language that these business people don't get.
Right.
So we can all look at each other and think of each other as ignorant or stupid, but really, in an ideal situation, every section of a business has people that have specialties that the others don't get, and everyone understanding those specialties a little more is going to bring everyone closer together and make things more productive.
Right. That makes sense. And, you know, it does seem like the best places that I've been where I've worked anyway were the places where, you know, everybody in the company, including the developers and the, quote, suits, you know, got along just fine and, you know, communicated well and talked over the things that were important. And, you know, everybody was more or less on the same page, as opposed to the places where it was, well, they don't get what we're doing. And, you know, this is kind of the way that we're just going to do it because, you know, they don't know. They don't get it.
Right. So, yeah, a good question, you know, something you can immediately take action on is if you're a developer, you have something you're going to be working on this week. You know, typically, people are working on one or two projects in the same week. Whatever that happens to be, ask yourself first, what is the actual business driver behind this? And I don't mean like, you know, who decided they wanted this mm-hmm. and what was their fuzzy reason, but how does this translate ultimately to be part of one of the key goals of the business that I'm in? And it doesn't have to be a business. It could be a nonprofit or whatever, you know. And if you don't know what that is, then start asking people. And don't do it in a condescending or, you know, negative way where you're questioning whether you should be doing it, but just use that as like the first step and always at least tying what you're being asked to do or what you've decided to do to an actual, you know, meaningful business metric.
Mm-hmm. That's really interesting. Yeah. You know, something that you can see and measure and kind of, you know about and feel. That's really interesting.
Right. And it also means that if they're the right metrics, they're unquestionably meaningful.
Right.
You know, for example, if there's something that you can do as a programmer that directly impacts revenue in either a proven way or as part of an experiment that the business is going to do, then there's no question about how important it is that you should do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it may be that it's actually not very important because you realize we could make an extra $100 a year on a multi-million dollar business if we make this change. You know, that's the kind of thinking that people need to do.
Mm-hmm.
But it also makes it easier to make arguments. If as a developer, you know, we're going to make $100 more a year because of this, you can go and say, look, this is going to take this much time, which translates roughly into this much money. It's actually not worth doing this feature.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can feel pleased that you're doing something that actually contributes to the business's success because, right. You know, hopefully you care about the business's success or you need to move on.
Yep. That makes sense. That makes a lot of sense. And yeah, I also agree with as far as being invested in the business, you know, caring whether or not they succeed. I've been in companies where, you know, I didn't have the vision. I didn't, you know, I ultimately, you know, I didn't want to go out of business because I didn't want to lose my job, but that was about the extent of it. And yeah, I mean, I ultimately became complacent and I really just didn't want to be there. So, you know, it is something that you need to care about it succeeding and then, yeah, make yourself a part of it. Now I have another area of questioning that I want to take on. And that is that since we last talked, I've actually gone freelance. And so I'm wondering, you know, how does all of this apply to somebody who isn't working for a company, who doesn't have to deal with suits and all of this? I mean, I can see choosing your specialty or area, but, you know, kind of beyond that, you know, how do you become remarkable, you know, where you don't really climb the corporate ladder?
Yeah, well, it kind of boils down to the first thing that we talked about, and that is you have to decide what you're trying to get out of this. You know, it might be that for you right now, the ability to have gone independent or freelance and not report to someone and, you know, set your own agenda, you might be there right now, you know, so then you have to decide where you want to go next. Do you want to stay independent and freelance by yourself? Do you want to build up a consultancy? Ultimately, though, whether you're working for a company or you're a freelancer, nothing in this book or my philosophy about how to run your career differs, because whether you're working for a company or you've started a business, you are the product that you're selling in all cases.
Right.
You don't have, when you get employed with someone, you don't have like a marriage that you've sworn to have last until you die. Mm-hmm. No one goes into business that way. What you really have is a business arrangement that says, I will work for you and I will roughly work full time and you will pay me this much money and I will deliver value to you.
Right.
So that's really no different from being freelance, except when you're freelance, you get to work for multiple companies. So you have to hustle a little more, or a lot more, really. You have to start drumming up your own business. I actually mention, it's one of the last chapters in the book, it's called Go Independent. Mm-hmm. And the reason that I suggest this is because all of the ideas in the book about, you know, choosing your market and investing and marketing and executing all this stuff, the ultimate test of it is when you no longer have a salary, can you keep going? Can you keep doing it?
Right.
Can you be successful that way? Because you're outside of your safety net. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think what you're doing now puts you in a great position to either grow the business that you're doing or go back into some sort of an employment relationship with a much stronger understanding of what your strengths are, and, you know, a proven track record of being able to execute as a business person. It's like a trial by fire to go independent.
Right. Yeah, there is a lot of that. And, you know, when I first got started, you know, I got laid off. So, I mean, I was looking for jobs and looking for clients at the same time. And it was just interesting. You know, you figure out really quickly, you know, whether or not you have skills that somebody wants to pay you for.
Right. And you also have to start answering questions like, if I get too many clients, do I overbook and work harder? Or, you know, what does my cash flow need to look like so that I can survive? And then you'll eventually, if you're doing well, you'll get into a situation where you have to turn down work.
Right.
That's a hard thing to learn about, or even fire customers because it's not the right fit. So all of that will really help build, you know, obviously a whole bunch of relevant experience. But I think maybe more importantly, a new level of confidence in your abilities. Now, it may be that you fail in certain ways. Uh-huh. So I'm not saying you're just going to go out there and it's going to be like rah, rah, cheerleading. Now I feel happy about myself. It might actually absolutely suck.
Mm-hmm.
You might find out that as a freelancer or as an independent, you are a failure. You're not good at it. You can't do it. You can't drum up business, or you're too stressed out trying to negotiate, so you keep getting low prices or whatever. If that's the case and you go back to the corporate world, you actually still have a newfound level of confidence, but that is that you know that you're in the right place and you know where your boundaries are.
Right. That makes sense. And you know, a lot of what you're talking about here, I mean, these are struggles that you have to go through. Cause I mean, you know, there have been a few people that have offered me work when I didn't have other work. And, you know, once I start talking to them about rate, you know, what they're offering and what I need are, you know, they're so different that even though I technically need the work, you know, I didn't feel like I could take it. Or, you know, you get into other positions where, you know, it's like, well, if I was a little better qualified in this way or that way, then I would have gotten the job instead of the other contractor. Or, you know, you really start to see, okay, well, If this is what it takes for my small business here to survive, then these larger businesses that employ multiple people, I mean, they have to cover all of these things, you know, times 10, plus manage it all and do all of the other things that go on. And you really get a good idea of, you know, what it means to, you know, be a successful business and to have, you know, the kind of relationships with your customers or clients, you know, that you need in order to survive and succeed.
Yeah, that's a really good insight that, you know, you can start to imagine, like, what if I hired two more people? Mm-hmm. What would I need to be successful? How could that be worth it for me?
Right.
Now that I'm doing this thing, you know, like, say you get a contract that really requires four people to execute on, mm-hmm. and you're the one guy. Well, you could go hire more people. That's risky, though. And you realize that, right?
Right.
As someone in a company may be hiring you, mm-hmm. as an employee, you realize that they have the same risk.
Right.
You know, they have, even as a corporate manager at a massive organization, you've only got so much budget. So whenever you hire someone, you're taking a risk on them, you know, mm-hmm. and you might not be able to get done what you need to get done if the person doesn't perform. And the other thing that you talked about, which is really good, is you now have a much more objective understanding of what your value is in dollars per time, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, there is a certain number that you can go to that'll probably be okay. You probably can think of another number that you could go to that's absolutely not going to work because you know what the market can pay for what you're going to do.
Right.
So your choices there as a freelancer are, one, develop a bigger reputation so that you can continue to do the same kind of work but charge more and at least be able to justify it based on what you've done in the past.
Mm-hmm.
The other is, look for opportunities where, like you said, if only my skills were a little higher here or there, I could have gotten that job or I could have asked for more money. You know, that gives you a very clear, directed way to improve your skills.
Right.
All yeah. based on value, which is basically it's the basis of my book, actually. You know, you're there to provide value to a business as a programmer. So learn how to do that and learn how you fit into the business.
Yep. And that's really the thing that I think, you know, people should be taking from it is you know, you have value. You have a value that you offer to the company. And ultimately, you know, if you're not continuing to work on that in some of the ways that we've talked about here, you know, your value will diminish. You know, maybe it is enough that you just have a job that you go, you take a paycheck and then you just go home and you don't even think about it. But you know, ultimately, as technology moves along, you know, you need to be providing that value or, you know, you're not going to have I'm trying to think of the way to explain what I'm trying to say, but maybe, you know, but anyway, so as you can continue to grow and offer, you know, more value to a company, then you will in turn gain more value. But the value that you get isn't necessarily the money that the company is giving you. There's a value in your work and the value in the enjoyment that you derive from it and things like that. And I think you covered all of those different areas of value that you get from having a job or, you know, working. And, you know, it really came together. It's hard to summarize, you know, everything that's in the book, but it really does, you know, provide you with an idea of the value that you both provide and retain from the work that you're doing.
Right. Yeah. And I guess as just an addendum to what you just said about deriving non-monetary value from your job, that's not necessarily always going to be true.
Mm-hmm.
So I've learned this lesson the hard way, but you know, the book is called The Passionate Programmer, and I think that the passion is like fuel. So someone who is passionate about what they're doing, and we've already sort of talked about this, but not in the exact words, but someone who is passionate about what they're doing is going to be better at it than someone who isn't. And the thing about passion and energy is you actually use it up as you work on something.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the ways to evaluate whether you're in the right place or doing the right job or doing it right or thinking about it right is, as I'm putting my passion into this thing, is it renewing that energy source? If it's not, you can actually run out, and then you're kind of screwed for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And I've done that. It's no good. It can take, depending on how bad you do it, it can take years to recover from. And while you're in that recovery period, you're still under-executing. You're underperforming based on your potential. Because right. when you're low in passion, you don't do as well. And you can even start, you know, you can go from great to I suck.
Mm-hmm.
So you cannot understate the importance of being able to derive more than monetary benefit from your employment.
Yeah, that's so true. And, you know, that's something that I have... we're getting a little echo again, but that's something that I've picked up on. It's something that I've felt... you know, that I should be gaining from my work is not just the money, but it's that satisfaction, it's that renewal of energy, it's the thing that drives me along. And if that's not there, then the job's not worth it.
Right. It's actually worse than not worth it.
Yeah, that's true. All right. Well, I think we're just about out of time, but I do appreciate you coming on the show. I'm going to recommend to everybody that they go and pick up your book. It's The Passionate Programmer. It's one of the Pragmatic Bookshelf books. And, you know, I have to agree with Michael Moore. It's definitely one of those books that I think every developer should read and understand.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate it. It's always a pleasure.
All right. Thanks, Chad.
Bye.
Bye. And we're back. I want to thank Chad again for coming on the show. He's always so interesting to talk to and has some great ideas about, you know, both coding and business and things like that. And so it's always just such a pleasure to have him on the show and talk to him. So thanks, Chad, for coming on. If you want to check him out, you can go to chadfowler.com and you can get pretty much all the information that you want as far as following him on Twitter. His Twitter handle is Chad Fowler as well. But, you know, just anything else that's going on. He's got some great articles on there, too. Like, he's got one on The Big Rewrite, which talks about, you know, basically taking your original code or original project and rebuilding it versus, you know, reworking it and things like that. So go check it out, chadfowler.com. And finally, I just want to thank New Relic again for sponsoring this podcast. And encourage you to go check them out. And again, if you need any help with your Ruby or Rails application, I also do Sinatra, and I'm looking at getting into iPhone. So, you know, you can contact me at 801-367-6164, or you can find me on Twitter, cmaxw, or email me, chuck@teachmetocode.com. Thanks.